Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining today's Alex Talk session on sanctions. My name is Simon Freakley. I'm the Chief Executive of Alex Partners, and it's my pleasure to welcome you today. I'm thrilled that we're joined by a global panel of experts on sanctions. I'm also thrilled that the chair of today's discussion will be Will Lewis. Will be known to many of you, of course, the former CEO of Dow Jones, the publisher of the Wall Street Journal. Now, obviously, top of mind for all of us is the humanitarian catastrophe that's playing out in Ukraine on a daily basis. And also, of course, acknowledging that whilst the economic sanctions that have been put in place so swiftly and so significantly and continue to ramp up are having an impact, we're all having to understand in this evolving picture how we comply and support those sanctions, but also how we understand how we manage reputational issues for those of us leading businesses that do still or have done business with Russia. This is the crux of today's discussion. So thank you for joining us. Thank you, Will, for chairing this. And at this point, I'll hand straight over to you.
Thank you, Simon, for that kind introduction. And this is indeed a fascinating and rapidly changing topic. And I'm delighted to be moderating this live discussion. Joining me for this discussion are Tom Scampion, Guy Harrison, and Wendy Wysong. Tom Scampion has spent the majority of his career helping to understand and manage sanctions risk for banks, technology companies, and regulators. He also led Deloitte's financial crime business in EMEA. Tom joined Alex Partners 3 years ago and has since worked with global firms in the field of sanctions, financial crime, and risk. Since the start of 2022, Tom has been CEO of an Alex Partners business called Global Screening Services, or GSS. GSS is an industry-driven initiative to create a central platform to improve the quality of sanctions screening for financial institutions. It's supported by global banks, leading technology firms, and has been positively received by regulators in multiple jurisdictions. Next is Guy Harrison, the CEO of Smart Search, an online provider of anti-money laundering and fraud prevention services. Before Smart Search, Guy was general manager of Dow Jones's risk and compliance business. Guy started his career as a consultant working at Deloitte before moving to Goldman Sachs' operations team and became head of global strategy and change management. He then moved to IHS Markit as managing director of risk, regulatory, and compliance solutions. And joining Tom and Guy is Wendy Wysong, a partner at law firm Steptoe & Johnson. Wendy focuses on regulatory compliance and white-collar defense of international laws, looking at corruption, international arms traffic, export regulations, US sanctions laws, and more. As a former assistant US attorney in Washington and deputy assistant secretary for export enforcement in the Department of Commerce's Bureau of Industry and Security, Wendy offers clients a unique combination of experience and insight as both a prosecutor and regulator before courts and agencies. Welcome to you all. What a fantastic panel we have here. And before we start, let me remind you that if you have any questions that you'd like me to ask, please do submit them in the chat function and I will do the necessary. So I want to dive straight in, if I may. The word unprecedented has been used countless times during the COVID pandemic, but it's fair to say that it is equally fitting when looking at the sheer amount of sanctions on Russia following its invasion of Ukraine. Tom, in this flurry of sanctions on Russian oil, assets, companies, individuals, obviously including oligarchs, can you give us a sense of perspective, please, as a multi-year veteran of the industry? How unusual a time is this? And give us that sense of understanding of how different it is now.
Thank you, Will. I'm delighted to be part of this panel. So I think it is unprecedented. Unprecedented is the right word. We were with the US Treasury last week, and I was with a couple of banks, and one of the banks is a top 10 global bank, and their head of sanctions, their global head of sanctions, used the phrase that, in his view, this was the most significant event in the history of economic sanctions. And I think he's right. And I think he's right for probably three reasons. I mean, one, it's been an incredibly hectic 6 weeks. I think it's 6 weeks to the day since the Ukraine was invaded. But I think it's unprecedented for three reasons. One is the volume, the sheer volume. You know, to add 1,000 names of you know, entities, businesses, and individuals is phenomenal, because it's not just the entities themselves, it's all their networks that you have to then go and understand. So that volume is pretty unprecedented. The second area I would point to is the speed. The EU are already on their fifth wave of sanctions as they look to increase the reach of sanctions. Because of course, the focus is on effectiveness, always on effectiveness. We don't have comprehensive sanctions. We have sanctions that are extensive, but they're yet to be comprehensive. And the third area is coordination. I think the world has been positively surprised by the coordination between the different jurisdictions and how people have looked to move together in the US, the UK, Canada, and the European Union. And of course, there have been dramatic events. I think the signal when Nord Stream 2 was cancelled, that was signaling to people this is different. This is where, you know, sanctions have a cost to the people issuing the sanctions, but they're done nonetheless. So I think that was an important moment. Obviously, SWIFT expelling seven banks, that's big news. I mean, last time that was, I think it was 2012 for the Iranian banks. And then finally, the coordinated effort to sanction the central Russian bank and do so really speedily. I think that was pretty extraordinary. I think the FT called it, you know, declaring financial war on Russia today. So I think that all of those things come together to say that this is a pretty unprecedented series of events. But as Simon said at the beginning in his opening comments, for understandable reasons.
Okay, so Wendy, I want to bring you in here. So volume, speed, coordination, all adding up to an unprecedented situation. Would you agree with that?
I would, but you know, I think one of the things Tom said that everybody really has to keep in mind that these are very complicated, they're very expansive, but they're not comprehensive. And that's in some ways makes things a little bit easier in the sense that, you know, there is still business to be done. But on the other hand, because it's so surgical and because they're so widespread across a number of different industry sectors, a lot of different companies, it also makes it more complicated and more difficult to make sure that you're in compliance. You know, it's not Iran, it's not North Korea, it's not Syria, not Cuba, not even, you know, the DNR or the LNR of Ukraine. I mean, this is, you know, something that we have to pay very, very close attention. And as you say, it's been, you know, these waves of sanctions, and even sometimes it just be one sanction a day for a while. And then all of a sudden you get another big wave. So it's something everybody has to pay attention to. It's not as easy as just, you know, completely blanking a country out.
Okay. All right. So unprecedented. And Guy, also fair to say, a very fast moving situation. And just in the last hour, we've got news of a new set of sanctions, including against two of Putin's daughters. Can you just tell us a bit about that? Were you surprised by that? And can you give us your broader analysis of one of the industry's leading participants? What does this mean at this stage?
Let me come on to the new sanctions in just a second. But I just want to add something to what Tom and Wendy were saying in terms of this being unprecedented. I think one of the things that's really stood out for me is that certainly companies in the West are not just looking to comply with the letter of the law, but they're actually moving ahead of regulation. And I think that's been, you know, something that we haven't really seen before. Companies not just doing what's legal, but arguably what's right as well, and withdrawing their own services from Russia ahead of the sanctions. I think also, in addition to that, when we've seen these types of sanctions being imposed previously, a lot of the conversation has been about what's Credit Suisse doing, what's Standard Chartered doing, the big banks. A lot of the narrative this time has been around the enablers. So I'm thinking of accountants, lawyers, estate agents, other people, as well as big corporates, multinationals, not just the financial services industry. So I think those are two things that really stood out for me in terms of what's been unprecedented. Coming on to what's been happening this afternoon, I think four big changes and, still catching up with the detail. As you said, it's incredibly fast moving, Will, and something very difficult for companies to address. But firstly, no new investment. These are US moves, by the way. No new investment into Russia. Secondly, further sanctions against the largest private bank, Alpha Bank, and the largest financial institution in Russia, Sberbank. You're also seeing other major state-owned companies getting further sanctions against them. And then finally, something that's great for grabbing headlines, we can debate the effectiveness of it. Certain individuals closely associated with Putin, and in particular his two daughters, and then also the family of Sergei Lavrov as well.
And are these surprising to you, Guy, or is it the same pattern as we've seen over the last 6 weeks?
No, I mean, I think, for people who've been following it closely, these have been reasonably well signaled in advance. I think also, there's a clear direction of travel that's been established now. And I think one of the things that's particularly interesting now is, hopefully we'll talk about the effectiveness of these sanctions. It's not just those who are close to the Putin regime who are being punished, but I think what the US, the UK, and the EU are looking to do now is really try and damage the Russian war machine by targeting people who perhaps aren't immediately associated with Putin and his regime, but can have a real economic effect on Russia and how they're funding their war effort, how they're propping up the ruble.
Right.
And I think, that has real implications for people who are doing business in Russia or with Russian entities at the moment.
Okay. Well, look, that's great. That level sets everyone on the call. So we know we are, and it remains a fast-moving situation. Of course, if any news breaks in the course of this meeting, we'll obviously update you as we go along. But Tom, I want to come to you on Guy's first point, which begins to take us into the practicalities for business, because it would appear one of the big themes out of all of this is it's no longer okay for businesses to simply comply with the law, even laws that are changing that fast. They have to, the added complexity of trying to keep up with different laws in the sanctions realm that differ by geography, and also have a very, very good ear out for how their broader stakeholder environment actually wants them to behave in regard to any involvement to Russia. Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Well, it's interesting. I've got a couple of perspectives, and I like Wendy's point about the fact that these are complex sanctions. And I thought I might just give a little example about the complexity, because I would argue that banks are on the front line. They're the institutions that are meant to sort of translate the designations into prohibitions and the conditions that have to be applied. But it's incredibly complicated if you're a bank at the moment dealing with this volume of challenge. And I absolutely buy Guy's point that you have to make a policy call. How close do you want to be to the actual letter of the law, and how much further do you wish to go? You'll notice Jamie Dimon made the comment, I think it was yesterday or today, that JP Morgan are happy to say that if the sanctions cost them money, they're costing money for the right thing if it's in the national security interest. So I think that there is clearly a decision to make that is beyond the simple letter of the law when it comes to compliance. But let me just give you a practical example of what it feels like to be in a bank at the moment. In 2014, after the Crimea annexation, 200 entities were designated. So 200 entities and individuals added to the list, roughly 200. That ended up being about 7,000 entities that had connections to those entities. Now, you don't know that off the bat. You don't know that immediately. You know that there's 200, but who are they connected to? What are their networks? That's incredibly hard to figure out, especially when we've got five times the volume in the last 6 weeks as a result of the new designations. Plus, where do you go for that information? Well, you go to corporate registries. Who owns who? Well, of course, what has Putin done? He's made it a treasonable offence to share that information of corporate registries outside of Russia. And so therefore, you know, punishable by hard labour. So there is a real challenge in trying to understand how you affect these sanctions. It's not just the name on the tin, it's actually what sits below that. And so that's very complicated. And of course, all of the sanctioned entities themselves are looking to conceal who they own, the relationship they have. And so there's not only sanction circumvention from the entities themselves, but also, you know, different jurisdictions may have a call about whether or not they want to hold on to the business and therefore conceal the true ownership that sits below that. So it comes back to my mind about effectiveness. How do you make sure that when these announcements are made, they actually get the desired effect? And that is not a trivial undertaking.
No. Okay. Well, I'll pick that a bit later on. And a reminder to everyone on this call that please do send in any questions using the chat function, and I'll look to weave them into our conversation. So thank you for that ahead of time. Guy, can I just come to you on the point that Tom made earlier about coordination? Can we just dig into that slightly? Because certainly there's been the West has united in condemning the invasion of Ukraine, but how in actual reality, how united are Europe and the US actually when it comes to applying the sanctions? Have we seen some divergence? Can you tell us a bit about that? And also, we've obviously also seen hundreds of US companies announce they're pulling out of Russia, but it's not the same, for example, in France, where lots of companies have decided to stay.
Yeah, so addressing those points in turn, I think at a headline level, there has been unprecedented is the word, coordination across the different regimes. But I think, you know, when you actually get to the practical implication of that, there is more coordination required. So, and clearly my stats are out of date because things are changing on an hourly basis at the moment. But if you're looking at the US, EU and UK, the UK sanctioned about 1,000 individuals, the US about 900 and the EU about 800. So all in all, let's say 1,000 of that population, only 300 individuals are sanctioned by all three regimes. And the reason that matters is because, in terms of circumventing the sanctions, unless there is that level of coordination and they're uniformly sanctioned, it's very difficult to enforce and easier for these people to get around the sanctions themselves. I think the other point to make there is that we're only really talking about the EU, the UK, and the US. There are plenty of other jurisdictions around the world who haven't taken any steps to withdraw from Russia or enforce sanctions of their own. And I think if you look at the movement of capital and physical assets, there's been, you know, a certain degree of sort of, you know, virtual assets moving towards the Caribbean, tax havens such as the British Virgin Islands, and physical assets moving either back to Russia or to countries such as Turkey or the UAE. And definitely those safe havens are narrowing. There are fewer of them, and transparency is improving. But while they exist, there is always a safety valve for these sanctions.
Okay. Let me leap in there for one sec. So, because Wendy, just to build on that, so Wendy, you're speaking to us kindly from Hong Kong. Can you just broaden out the our understanding of how countries and governments are responding to this? Can you give us the Asian perspective, and obviously in particular China, and obviously China looming large in this? What's the situation there, please?
So, you know, in Asia, there really hasn't been sort of a united front on either side of this. You know, obviously, everybody's looking very closely at China and India, those folks, you know, they stood out. They did not even, they abstained from the vote in the United Nations, as did Pakistan and Vietnam and Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Laos, Mongolia. They all abstained and didn't vote. On the other hand, you know, you've got Australia, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, that were aligned, you know, as Western allies. And so you've got a split in Asia. Companies that are watching China or operating in China are having to really think through what they want to do in terms of their compliance with these Western sanctions, because conceivably, you know, China's got an anti-foreign sanctions law that if a company complies with the Western sanctions to the disadvantage of a Chinese company, they could get put on China's own list and they could be sued by the company. So that was disadvantaged the Chinese company. So companies are having to deal with that. China's got its own issues in deciding what they want to do. You know, obviously they're watching all of this with Taiwan and thinking about how that's going to impact them, thinking about, you know, their relationship with Russia. Obviously they're benefiting with the discounted oil and gas and, you know, food supplies and things like that, that, you know, they're the, you know, the biggest market for Russia right now, that they can, you know, still supply from. You know, they're a little worried about getting too close to Russia though, because if, you know, their ally in the invasion fails, you know, then they've been aligned with, you know, somebody that they may not want to have been allied with. So they're in a difficult position. I can't decide. I sort of go back and forth whether or not they're sort of in the catbird seat here, or if they're, you know, walking a very, very narrow tightrope in trying to make sure that they, you know, their interests are protected. And certainly companies that are operating in China are definitely on edge and trying to consider how they comply and what the risks are. If they have an obligation to comply with the Western sanctions.
Okay, well, talking of edge, our dynamic conversation thus far has got a flurry of questions coming in from the audience. So, and they're itching for us to start talking about what's going to happen next. We will get to that, I promise. So stick around. We're going to talk about likely next sort of raft of sanctions. But a question maybe for you, Tom, from Fahad. Thank you for that. How are non-financial companies going to put in place processes to comply? Telco, retail, et cetera, which have large consumer databases and they don't have much past experience doing this?
Well, it's a good question. So there are, you know, I think there's a natural sequence of events here. The first thing is to determine a policy. So I think that any organization in any industry, the first thing you do is you determine what's your policy, because into your policy, you'll be able to say, what is my risk appetite? Against which you'll then be able to assess whether or not the business that you're doing is inside or outside of your risk appetite. Then you can look at the effectiveness of your controls and you can decide, okay, I'm where I need to be or I'm not, and you can make changes. But I think being deliberate is really important. So for example, let's say you're a telco. You will then have a number of customers and you can make a call. Not just a legal call. There'll be regulatory requirements, of course, but you can make a call as to whether you wish to have businesses, customers that are in any way connected to the sanctioned entities. And you can go through the classic sanction screening approach to understand the nature of these folks and decide whether or not they're people that you want to have as your business, as your customers. But I think the first thing that you really need to be focusing on is what is your policy? What is the position you wish to take? Because actually you could argue some of the restrictions are very much manageable for the non-financial institutions, but there could be consequences elsewhere, especially if you are perceived to be transferring value, which some of the, for example, telco organizations would be doing. So I think be deliberate, have a policy, set a risk appetite, and then look at the effectiveness of that risk appetite being controlled through your different business operations, your customers, your supply chain, your investors, and so on. That would be my immediate reaction to that question.
Great. Okay. Well, you more than answered Fahad's question. So thank you for that. Winnie, can I just come back to you then, just on the Asian perspective? So for businesses, this must be very difficult. If you've got different rules in different territories, you're a global enterprise. which rules rule? Who should you, who, when also, I mean, is it in the, I remember it being Singapore in the old days, but who do we look to never break their rules and worry less about others?
Well, obviously, you know, you never break anybody's rules. You know, there's a calculation that you have to make. And I want to go back a second with Tom's question, you know, with the screening and, you know, making sure that you've got all of your folks, you know who your customers are, you know who has access to your data, you know all of that. The other thing is you have to consider, you know, who all of your business partners are. You know, you may think that you don't have any connections, you know, and that you're safe, but if you can't get your business partners to allow you to do your business, your banks, you know, might not have the same risk appetite you've got. Your supply chain, your logistics providers, you know, all of those folks, you've got to consider what the practical impact is. Even though you're insulated, you know, you have to think about, you know, how are you actually going to be able to do the business that you're entitled to do? And then in terms of figuring out, you know, if you have to make a choice, if you have to figure out, you know, do I go with the Western sanctions? Do I, you know, am I more concerned about blocking statutes and all of that? You know, obviously the United States has a long history of enforcement. You know, and so you need to look at what your risk is of enforcement with regard to the United States, I think, you know, is sort of a primary concern, and make a balance, you know, and try and figure out, you know, if that's a realistic threat or risk, or are you de-risking completely unnecessarily? And are you ignoring the fact that you've got this Chinese anti-foreign sanctions law that actually might have a more direct impact on you than sort of an existential threat that, you know, at some point the United States might turn its attention to you. So, you know, there is a balance there that you've got to strike. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, consulting with other folks in your industry, consulting with, you know, your consultants that you've hired to give you advice on these risks, and making sure that you're accurately balancing and weighing the risk before you make a decision as to, you know, which side you're going to be on.
Okay, and so Guy, in light of this complexity and the disparities, obvious question, but how effective actually are the current sanctions? Because I did read with some interest in the week Alexei Mordashov and the way that he appears to have moved billions of dollars worth of assets ahead of time. I think the FT reported a stake in TUI, for example, that he moved into the ownership of his third wife. What are some of the tricks that oligarchs are using to avoid? And can you tell us your view about the broad effectiveness of them, please?
Sure. I mean, firstly, thank you for directing that last question to Wendy, not me. Whose rules matter? And Wendy, compliment you on your answer there. It was excellent. I think you're exactly right. We touched on it earlier, right? While there are safe havens for all these sorts of assets, and while these sanctions are being signaled well ahead of time, people are able to circumvent them and store these stores of wealth offshore and away from sanctioned entities. I think, you know, I definitely echo what Wendy was saying before in terms of just how difficult these sanctions are to implement because of the disparities between the different regimes, and then also understanding really what sits in your supply chain, what sits in your customer base, who are my suppliers. Right. And it seems that that's especially important at the moment, because in the court of public opinion, really, there seems very little forgiveness. You know, you talked earlier about some of these French companies, and we saw what happened with Decathlon last week and their reversal of their decision to to stay in Russia and in fact actually pull out. So they are incredibly difficult to navigate. I think knowing who you're doing business with is the most important step in the implementation of those regimes. Coming back to your question on the effectiveness, though, Will, I think until we see oil and gas really come into these regimes in a meaningful way, and actually Russia isn't able to run a current account surplus, it'll be arguable about how effective these sanctions are. If we go back to what happened with Iran, they saw a 20% drop in recession in their economy. They still stuck it out for an exceptionally long time. And I think that could well be the case with Russia as well.
Okay, well, let's get into the gas question, Guy, off the back of that, because I can detect from the questions that are coming in, and thank you very much to the audience for the questions, they really want to get into what you, the experts, think is going to happen next, what should happen next. And, for example, we've got a question from Hinda Rabkin saying, where do you see sanctions on Russian gas going? Panelists will have read Martin Wolf's column in the Financial Times calling on sanctions specifically around gas, but also everyone's very mindful of the profound economic impact that will have, particularly on the German economy. And I think it was the Belgian Prime Minister who said sanctions must have a greater impact on the Russian side than on the European side. We don't want to wage war on ourselves. Tom, why don't we get started with you? Do you foresee a broadening and deepening of sanctions? Do you see in particular them leading towards gas at some stage in the near future?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there, aren't there? I mean, inevitably, oil and gas are the focus areas simply because, for example, how much Europe is dependent on Russian oil and Russian gas. I think 25% of the oil that comes into Europe is from Russia and 40% of the gas. Now, this will be a judgment call, in my view, about the efficacy of these sanctions. Are they getting the desired effect? Remember, sanctions are what you do before you go to war. They're the last thing you do before you go to war to prosecute your foreign policy objectives. Now, if your foreign policy objectives are not being met, I think you do have to consider things that come with a significant personal economic cost to the people who are issuing the sanctions. So I'd slightly disagree with the Belgian perspective. I think we're already seeing the fact that there are significant costs being borne by the people who are issuing these sanctions. So the judgment call will be, are we getting the required response from the sanctions? And my two cents from speaking to the US Treasury last week is that there is a profound focus on trying to measure whether or not the effects that are being seen are happening. You know, that before Biden decided to sell more oil into the, or at least more oil into the global economy, I think the sanctions were estimated to have just a 2% effect on the Russian economy because of the increase in the price of oil. So there are a number of levers at play. I don't think we are going to be as a globe frightened of that issue of the suffering the individual cost, but it will be a judgment call. It'll be a judgment call by the policy issuers to say, are we getting the returns that we expected in terms of the sanctions being issued?
And that raises the elephant in the room, though, issue. With what is the definition of success of these sanctions? What is success? If we were putting, you know, KPIs against them, what intention is it to make us in the West feel better that we're doing something? Is it actually going to cause some profound issue for Putin? Wendy, would you like to address what we think the definition of success is for these sanctions?
Right, and you know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is, you know, while the sanctions were being considered, I mean, this has been 6 months. I know people that have been working on, you know, how this rollout was going to work well before, you know, any of it actually materialized. There's still several steps, several things that can happen. You know, we haven't reached the end of it. We can do, sanctions on coal. We can do, we could do something with Venezuela. You know, there's obviously been attempts to try and figure out what we can do about the 2019 ban on the importation of Venezuelan oil. You know, there's things that can be done to lessen the impact. And but I agree, it's going to be oil and gas ultimately that is going to probably what turns the tide. As far as where you're going to turn the tide, obviously, there was some, conjecture as to, regime change and things like that, which was quickly stepped back. I don't think that is what any country is actually aiming for. What they're trying to do is get to a peace, a lasting peace in that region. And I think the way they're going to do that is a combination of these sanctions and strengthening and making them hurt more and more and more. It's probably going to be weapons sales and weapons deliveries and donations and things like that, that's also going to play. I don't think anybody's kidding themselves. It's all going to be, sanctions driven, that the whole thing is going to be, influenced only by sanctions. It's a combination of things. But I think it's a lasting peace and coming up with a negotiated settlement and forcing real negotiations to take place is, I think, the ultimate goal here.
Guy, what's your perspective, please, on that?
I think that sanctions can actually play a very real role in preventing further escalation. And by the way, to your previous question, I think that oil and gas will be sanctioned. I think the question is less will they or won't be, but once they are, how long can we actually sustain those sanctions, and how long can we sustain the kind of the home impact of those sanctions? But I think if we do that, then really you're removing the funding for the Russian war effort, and that if you can remove that funding, then that should bring about a peace sooner rather than, I would hope that it would bring about a peace sooner rather than later. There's a very helpful tracker online which shows how much the EU has paid Russia for fossil fuels since the 24th of February. That's currently standing at 20 billion.
Wow. So there's a lot of really helpful trackers on the internet. And sort of, Guy, getting to your point about what companies are doing, what companies are actually doing. Yale does a very interesting tracking where they've tracked companies that have actually withdrawn completely, some that have suspended, some that are scaling back, some that have dug in, and making, I think there's five gradations that they're listing, And so, I think it's been fascinating figuring out the information, and how these things are being tracked to figure out what impact is actually taking place. So instead of looking just at the headlines, everybody's leaving Russia, you can actually sort of figure out more of the nuances as to the impact of these sanctions.
And Tom, I want to come to you in a second to talk about the US Treasury, because that obviously in all of these conversations looms large. But there is another question that's come in, which is slightly off message, but when I get it in, it's from Peter Maines, which is quite interesting. Given the reaction to the likes of McDonald's, is social media more effective than legal sanctions? Now, I'm looking at you, Wendy.
I think as soon as they start publishing the names of the companies and what they're really doing, the reason that they're publishing those names is to try and encourage pressure. And you've seen a lot of the companies are saying that, we have to withdraw because of external pressure, or we have to withdraw because of the logistics and our supply chain, or we have to withdraw, they don't come right out necessarily and say we're doing what's right, but the right thing is, Disney maybe not sending new movies, but that was their first move. And then they, because of external pressure, they pulled out more and more. Companies are leaving for all different kinds of reasons, but there's certainly an impact that social media is having. And you also have to consider the misinformation that's going through on social media India, and that's also got a huge impact. And whether or not, you know, the Russians are being told what's really going on, and, you know, the other countries are actually getting an accurate picture of what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah, can I ask this, because you maybe Tom or Guy, for you, I mean, there is obviously some very clear reasons why a lot of the sanctions have been put in place against individuals, against companies. But I know a lot of people in business, and they wouldn't say it publicly, but are getting increasingly uncomfortable with people who appear to have got sanctioned because they have a Russian-sounding name. I think there was someone recently, a woman in London, who I think is the daughter of a Russian business person, whose main crime appeared to be that she bought an apartment without a mortgage. What do we feel about the absence of potentially the rule of law, where something that you own, a property, a plane, whatever it may be, can be seized by the state? Do we all feel comfortable about this?
Well, you're jumping into the unexplained wealth order debate in the UK as to whether or not that's an effective way to try and encourage more transparency, of course. There is a big debate between the US, I would say, and I'd love Wendy's view on this, a big debate between the US view of focusing on the effectiveness of sanctions. And in Europe, there is a much greater focus, I think, traditionally, maybe it's changed in the last 6 weeks, on the rights of the individual, especially when it comes to information sharing and data protection. And that is a continual challenge. And therefore, you know, people will, of course, challenge whether or not they have been fairly put on some of these lists. The before Ukraine, there were significant steps that people had to jump through in the United Kingdom to put people on these lists. You had to have, you know, a demonstrable case, given our legal system, to prove that there was a reason for people being on these lists. Whereas, of course, there's the executive order focus in the US and actually in the European Union. So you did have a tension, though, between the rights of the individual to be fairly treated against actually the rights of the states to create a safe, protective environment against things like, you know, bad actors, terrorists, and so on. So I think this is kind of playing out in front of us as we speak. And I'll be interested to see whether or not we reset the challenges between data privacy, information sharing, and the rights of the individual against the challenges of saying, well, by information sharing, by embracing a global approach to sanctions, we will be more effective in their execution. I think that will become a very hot topic very soon.
Mm. But given, just to drive that on, I mean, given that the consensus of this group appears to be the sanctions are not going away anytime soon, and most likely are going to deepen and lengthen. I mean, how sustainable in the West are the sanctions going to be when they do begin to make a material impact to people's cost of living over and above what's already begun to happen? How sustainable do we think they are, or is it something that the West can only keep going for a short while?
I think you're right to raise the question, Will. And I think also, you know, there may well be some fatigue that sets in terms of people's attention span and their sympathy with the Ukrainian situation, particularly as the so-called cost of living crisis starts to bite. I think, again, coming back to your very first point around this being unprecedented, there isn't necessarily a model that we've seen that we can replay over this scenario. I think, however, if we do start to see more human rights abuses and discoveries of war crimes throughout Ukraine, and those are broadly publicized and well evidenced, I think, again, public opinion will sustain these sorts of sanctions for quite some time yet.
Okay. All right. Well, let's throw it forward if we can, because clearly our audience is very keen for each of you to address the issue of what's likely to happen next. We've touched on some of the issues with gas, for example, but how far do we think individual sanctions all go? Will it begin to include non-Russian business people who have done business in this former Soviet Union years back? Could sanctions extend to advisors to oligarchs and investors in Russian business? How should people begin to think about the next gears that governments could go through?
I mean, obviously, we've got, you know, the industry sectors that they're, you know, going to continue to tweak and worry with. But I do think that, you know, with the withdrawal of law firms and accounting firms that have left Russia, the concern about the attention that's been paid as to the role that that they played in advising the oligarchs as to how to set up these complicated ownership structures that are non-transparent, you know, they're being named and shamed, you know, and so public opinion is being shaped by their role. So whether or not they actually get sanctioned, you know, it's more difficult. You know, I'm allowed to give advice on how to comply with sanctions. I'm not allowed, you know, to give advice on how to evade sanctions and how to, you know, structure your business to evade sanctions, that kind of thing. Because, you know, the OFAC and the US regulators want us to give advice, you know, in compliance, and they want us to help companies. You know, I spend a good amount of time getting to your point, Tom, working with companies that are put on these lists, you know, rightly or wrongly, and trying to find proof that, you know, in the basis for those listings, and if there is no proof, if there is no basis, you know, helping those companies get off those lists. And that's a proper role for, you know, the lawyers and advisors to fulfill, and something to be encouraged. The other, you know, is something that you know, they're going to shine a light on. They're going to, you know, look into who's been enabling and facilitating, you know, some of this action. You know, the U.S. has said that, you know, right now they're not looking at secondary sanctions because there's just so much animosity towards secondary sanctions where there's no U.S. nexus. You know, but it is something that the U.S. sort of threatens to pull out if need be. So, you know, it is something that we're following really closely. I probably get a question about that every day. You know, is it likely they're going to look at secondary sanctions? And so, you know, they're...
Which is very unsettling for people, isn't it, Wendy? Because we, you know, it's a great uncertainty. I mean, Guy, if you were advising a business that in some way in the past had involvement with or has ongoing interest, either direct or indirect, what sort of advice would you give them? Should they make a proactive offer to the government? Should they issue a statement? Should they make a charitable? What's the best approach for business to take if it is ensnared in some shape or form in the Russian economy?
So, I mean, I'm neither a lawyer or a PR advisor, just a humble RegTech provider. But I think, and every situation will be different. The thing that I would be doing in any business situation at the moment is understanding who I do business with, either as a customer or supplier, and who those companies do business with, so that I have an absolute detailed understanding of my third parties and their third parties, what business I've done with them, where I've done it as well. And only once I've got that viewpoint, that I've demanded that viewpoint and I've got a good answer, would I then be in a position to decide whether, you know, a proactive disclosure or some sort of public statement or so on would be required. But I think you need the information, you need the facts at your fingertips before you can even start to make some of these sorts of decisions.
Yeah. Okay. So know what you can know before you make any changes.
Tom, if I might add just on that point, Will, I would also say be really clear about what your business position, your appetite is for this. I remember working for a bank where I was the global head of sanctions, and the bank had got a policy which said that, we will apply the OFAT restrictions independent of a US nexus. I don't care if it's a transaction which has no dollar involved, no US persons, and of course is physically remote from the US, I'm going to apply it. Why? Because the risk appetite of the bank was to say, I want to focus on looking after our reputation, and therefore I'm choosing to do it. But that's a decision. That's a decision which is, of course, fundamentally a policy call about the risk appetite of the business.
And Tom, while we've got the mic, gaze into your crystal ball for us. How is this likely to play out for individuals, businesses? What's your view, please?
Look, I think so. And for fear of covering ground that's already been covered, I'd say I think we know where we're going to go with some of the energy, the oil, the gas, particularly, and that would increase. I wanted to pick up on the public relations aspect of it, and I too am not a public relations expert, but let me give you a perspective on it. I think that the reputational risk is what is going to be driving people's compliance with way beyond the regulatory expectations. People will be making a call. Firms are making a call as to which side of this debate do you want to be on. So I think it is going to be less about the ordinance, less about the actual sanctions themselves, and more about businesses reflecting on where they want to be, which side of history do you want to be on. And I think that's going to drive it. And I think social media is the engine that provides that energy for that drive.
Okay. Well, look, it's been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you very much. Tom, I just want to put the final question to you, if I may. What does this all end up as? So should we settle in for long-term sanctions? Are we going to split from Russia entirely, or are these temporary measures while the war plays out?
I think my colleagues answered it very well. When we think about the objectives, the purpose of this, and once the purpose is met, I think we move into a different space. Whether that's in a series of weeks or a series of months or even longer, unfortunately, only time will tell.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I'm going to hand back in a minute to Simon, but just thank you very much, Tom, Wendy, Guy. It's been a fascinating conversation. I've learned huge amounts. As has everyone who's joined in. So thank you very much. And now, Simon.
Thank you, Will. And thank you, Wendy, Guy, and Tom, for leading a really insightful discussion. A particular thanks, of course, to you, Wendy, where I know it's beyond midnight now from where you're speaking. Thank you all. Obviously, issues of real complexity here. We all understand the imperative of these sanctions, but understand the complexity of administering them, of course, is core to us all stepping up to our understanding and responsibilities. So a great discussion to explore that. I agree, Tom, with the point you've just made. I agree with many points that were made in the last hour. But Tom, when you talked about the reputational test really being the higher bar than the strict compliance with the sanctions, I think all of us in our business are having to be very, very mindful of that. Now, obviously, we all hope that this humanitarian catastrophe is going to be over soon, very soon, we hope. But in the meantime, we at Alex Partners will be leading talks like this, supported by Will and others, as we explore some of the further complexities to understand how we step through it, in addition to the other disruptions, of course, that we're all managing every day. So thank you again to the team. Thank you all for joining us today. And we very much look forward to seeing you on future sessions. Thanks so much.